This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
How much do you know about money? It's an important question because a new survey shows that the majority of students in the U.S. get their financial education at home, and that education is lacking.
They tend to learn from their parents, and they don't know very much.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about that survey and how one high school economics teacher is working to increase her students' financial literacy. We'll also learn how an event in outer space indirectly opened the door to college to millions of American women. And we'll spend an academic minute feeling loved. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. For over a dozen years, April has been recognized as Financial Literacy Month. In some states, economics and financial literacy is a high school graduation requirement. One of those states is Florida, and I recently visited a high school in Pensacola to learn about their financial literacy curriculum. We'll hear from that teacher in a minute or two, but the fact is that most students get little to no financial literacy education in high school. A recent survey by Junior Achievement shows most students get information on managing money from their parents. Jack Kosakowski is the president and CEO of Junior Achievement USA. He says the results of their annual survey have remained pretty consistent over the years.
And that's been the same for the last 20 years that we've been doing this. So that, you know, really puts a responsibility on parents. Beyond that, they then go down to social media sites to get information, which, you know, depending which site they go to, could be good or could be problematic. And then even beyond that, they would extend the reach out to other members of their family or friends.
The survey results were also somewhat predictable when it came to students' financial worries.
Having money to go to college was their top concern with money. The second had to do with finding a well-paying but meaningful job when they get out of school. And then beyond that, they're thinking even longer term in terms of, will they be able to afford to purchase a home?
It's not how much money you make, it's what you do with it.
Duana Stiles is an economics teacher at Escambia High School in Pensacola, and many of her students are from lower income families. She agrees that most of her students get their financial education from their parents, but they still have a lot to learn.
Okay, we're not going to have a life of poverty because your parents were lower income. We are the greatest country on earth. So just because you're poor, that doesn't dictate your future.
In her class, Stiles not only teaches the nuts and bolts of making a budget and balancing a checkbook, but also common sense lessons about getting the most from your income.
I try to teach the students about generic and name brand products. I taught them to read labels to see that this product is the exact same as something else. I teach them how to make sure they get the cheapest car insurance, the best cell phone deal, their college. Try to avoid as many student loans as possible. I just try to teach them real-life experiences with economics.
And one of those real-life experiences is actually shopping for car insurance.
They're assigned an insurance company. I have two cars. I normally use my cars, so I know how much they cost per month. And they have to call, go online, or visit the insurance company in person. And they have to tell me how much they're going to pay for insurance per month. They have to go and actually get a mock quote. So that's a real-life experience. You want this fancy car. Your car is $400 per month or more. Your insurance is $3, and you only make $12. So where are you going to live? So I make them have a very realistic budget.
Duana Stiles' classroom is filled with pictures of students she has taught over the past 15 years, many of whom give her credit for helping them get a head start on their financial life. And speaking of credit.
Oh, I tell them credit is very important. That is your lifeline. That sometimes it's not how much money you make, it's how high your credit scores are. And you need to make sure you guard it. I start telling them right away that you pay your bills on time. Your economics is about choices. The choices you make today will affect you later on in life. And even at 5 years from now, 10 years, 20, the choices you make, it will affect you. It depends on where you live, what type of car you drive. what type of community you live in, your student loan. Economics is all about choices. And with choices, some come consequences. It could be good or bad.
According to the latest Florida high school graduation requirements, a student must have 24 credits to graduate. And those credits must include a half credit in economics. And that must include financial literacy. Jack Kosakowski from Junior Achievement says nationwide, financial literacy is still not a big priority in schools.
One of the interesting stats that came out of this survey, for example, is that 95% of the students that we interviewed believe that this should be taught in school, yet only 18% said that they're getting any kind of this information in their school.
But back at Escambia High School, Duana Stiles continues to teach her students about financial literacy and to strive to be better than the generations that came before.
You're a new generation. You're supposed to be wiser than your parents. You're supposed to know more. And that's what I often tell them. You should live longer than your parents because of all the advances that we have in science. You should be better. Your generation should be better. And you should be wiser as a consumer than your parents because we have more knowledge, see? Knowledge is power.
And earlier we heard from Jack Kosakowski, the president and CEO of Junior Achievement USA, and I thought you'd like to hear my full conversation with Jack about that annual Junior Achievement Survey on financial literacy. I started by asking him about the survey.
Well, Bob, Junior Achievement has been doing this survey annually for the past 20 years as part of National Financial Literacy Month because we really want to find out where kids are in terms of managing money. And so this year, with the help of AIG, we did the survey and found out some things that maybe aren't a big surprise at some levels, and that is, you know, number one, yes, kids are concerned about money. Primarily, they identified that they're concerned about having money to go to college was their top concern with money. The second had to do with finding a well-paying but meaningful job when they get out of school. And then beyond that, they're thinking even longer term in terms of will they be able to afford to purchase a home.
Where did you find that kids are getting their education, financial education, now?
Well, Bob, that's a great question. On this year's survey, 70% of the students said that they go to their parents as the point of contact for any information about managing money. And that's been the same for the last 20 years that we've been doing this. So that, you know, really puts a responsibility on parents. Beyond that, they then go down to social media sites to get information, which, you know, depending which site they go to, could be good or could be problematic. And then even beyond that, they would extend the reach out to other members of their family or friends. And so, you know, with parents being at the top of that list, we really owe it to be able to provide adequate information to our students on managing money.
It's interesting now when you say your parents are going to have that talk with their kids, they could be talking about financial literacy.
Well, exactly. In fact, over the years, I began calling this the new birds and the bees talk because it's very similar in that you're really uncomfortable having this conversation, mostly because many of us as parents didn't necessarily get the information that we needed. And then you add on top of that, if I share with my child how I'm managing my bills and my debt, it gets to be a very uncomfortable conversation.
Are parents usually open about their financial situation with their kids?
Well, as you might imagine, parents that are struggling financially would be less likely to do that. You know, so our recommendation to parents is to start in a very basic way with their kids in terms of how they talk to them. You know, the recommendation is, number one, that they start young, and number two, that they keep the discussion about managing money relevant to the age of the child. And so, you know, an example I would give of that is that parents should start as early as elementary school with allowances, you know, for chores that are done. And by having an allowance, the child then has some money, which provides the opportunity for the parent to talk to the student at their level about doing a budget. And part of that is they're able to share the very basic knowledge that not even adults all have, and that is you can't spend more money than you take in. and can get to the very basic concept of how do you determine wants versus needs, very basic way. And so, you know, for an elementary student, for example, I would suggest that when they have this allowance and they create a budget, that maybe they create a target goal for purchasing a particular bicycle, game, toy, video game as the long-term objective so that they know they need to save. But also sharing with them that, you know, as you go along, you need to have some fun. So a certain part of that budget is allocated for expenses short-term, a candy or some much cheaper toy sort of thing. And then as your child matures, they get to their teen years, you can have the very similar budget conversations around an automobile, the maintenance on a car, the gasoline, and those sorts of things. So keeping it relevant, our greatest fear is that parents will introduce complex topics before kids are ready for it and then just turn them off to the whole idea of managing their money.
Is this something that school districts and maybe individual schools are starting to do for their students?
Bob, that's a great question. You know, since 2008 and the Great Recession, there are many more school districts that are requiring a course in financial literacy, but it's really hit or miss as you go across the country. One of the interesting stats that came out of this survey, for example, is that 95% of the students that we interviewed believe that this should be taught in school, yet only 18% said that they're getting any kind of this information in their school.
Students now have so much more access to credit. Is that something that should be talked about more?
It absolutely is. And, you know, I think what comes top to mind of credit is college debt. And certainly, I think some of the indicators there are that had they had more experience with credit growing up, perhaps they wouldn't be in the situation they're in. You know, we tend to be an all-or-nothing sort of society where you may label credit as being, you know, a bad thing. And our view on that is credit is a tool. It's a little bit like a hammer. If you use a hammer wrong, you're going to hurt yourself. But if you use it properly, it's a great tool. So if we can teach kids, even in high school, use of a credit card in an appropriate way, it's a good thing. You know, the teaching about keeping balances up. It's a great way, if I were a math instructor, I would use the interest that's paid on a credit card as a way to teach math. So there's really a lot of opportunity to use these basic skills as a way to teach more foundational skills.
You've been in your position now for over 10 years. Was there something in this survey that made you sit back and go, oh, I didn't see that coming?
Yes, actually there was. You know, the good news is at the beginning of the interview, we talked about 75% of the students concerned about financing their college education, which is a good thing because you got 75% of the kids wanting to go to college. The thing that popped out of this survey that we've not seen before is that only 50% of the respondents identified financial independence from their parents as a goal. For us, and of course, when, you know, we lived through this millennial situation where there were a lot of the boomerang kids coming back to live with their parents, maybe that is turning into a longer term what students would see as an opportunity.
So if you are a student and you're not getting much help from home and the school isn't doing much, where can a kid go?
Well, kids are inclined to go to the web, and so I would encourage students to seek out reliable information that they can obtain. You know, the one that naturally I would encourage students to go to is the Junior Achievement website, which is ja.org. And on that site, we have a wealth of information that the students can tap into. And sort of adjacent to that website is another site called jamyway.org, which is has some games and activities that drive home the basic economic concepts that we've been talking about. Part of the survey that I hope parents take the time to take a look at is the very critical role that they play in the development of not just the knowledge that their children are going to have in terms of managing their money, but also the attitude or the responsibility factor that comes along with that. So parents have a major role in the education of their child when it comes to managing money.
Jack Kosakowski is the president and CEO of Junior Achievement USA, and you can read more about the results of this survey at juniorachievement.org. Still to come, how did an historic event in outer space affect the makeup of college student populations in the U.S.? That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Women outnumber men on college campuses, but that wasn't always the case. Today we have this story from our friends at the Ways and Means podcast, hosted by Emily Hanford.
Meet Hubertine Scott.
Okay, well, I was born the third of seven children in St. Paul, Minnesota. I grew up during the Great Depression.
She wanted to go to college, but her father wouldn't let her.
College was not even a remote possibility. I was told, take shorthand and typing, marry the boss, and you're set.
After Hubertine Scott got married, she still wanted to go to college. Her husband finally agreed, but he had conditions.
He told me I had to be home when the children left for school at 9, and be home when they got home at 3, dinner on the table at 6, and in bed at 10.
And it wasn't just husbands and fathers who made it hard for women to get degrees. Colleges did too.
Colleges routinely used gender quotas.
This is Duke University professor Deandra Rose. She wrote a book about the history of women's access to college called Citizens by Degree.
Some colleges actually just outright excluded women entirely. And so women knew that if I wanted to go to college, I'm going to have higher grades than the men who are also applying for college at the same time. And even then, you could get your application returned to you with just a note that says women need not apply.
Enter an unlikely hero, Carl Elliott. He was a young lawyer in Alabama when he ran for Congress in 1948. He wanted the federal government to help make it easier for all young people to get college degrees, especially poor kids. Carl Elliott's parents were tenant farmers. He traces his love of learning to his grandmother.
She taught me a great deal about the love of reading because she read so beautifully.
After high school graduation, Carl Elliott set off for the University of Alabama on foot with just $2 in his pocket.
He literally left home walking to get here. And it was 120 miles from where he lived in Franklin County.
This is Mary Allen Jolly.
He spent two nights sleeping under a truck because he had nowhere to live. He often told me the greatest achievement I ever made in my life was to get a college education. He said it was nearly impossible.
After he was elected to Congress, Carl Elliott hired Mary Allen Jolly as his aide, and he drafted a proposal for the federal government to start offering college scholarships. But Southern states worried that if they allowed the federal government to provide funding for anything related to education, the feds might demand faster school integration. So his proposal went nowhere. But then...
Today, a new moon is in the sky, a 23-inch metal sphere placed in orbit by a Russian rocket.
October 4th of 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1, and... as a result, the U.S. lost the space race, the race to space.
This is Professor Deandra Rose again.
You are hearing the actual signals transmitted by the Earth-circling satellite, one of the great scientific feats of the age.
So with this stunning defeat in the space race, the United States panicked.
The day Soviet scientists jauntily drop-kicked the first Sputnik around the world, the average American was shocked, bewildered, and resentful.
Carl Elliott and his colleague, an Alabama senator named Lister Hill, decided the time was right to pitch their scholarship proposal again. But this time, they'd argue that federal support for helping needy kids get to college was crucial to ensuring the nation's security.
They gave it a fancy new title, and they called it the National Defense Education Act.
They called for $1.6 billion for scholarships and student loans, and anyone could apply, even women.
So it changed my life in a whole bunch of ways.
Thanks to the National Defense Education Act, Hubertine Scott is now Dr. Hubertine Scott. She was able to get a PhD because of the money that program provided. She now lives in a retirement community in Alabama, where, in a surprising twist, one of her neighbors is Mary Allen Jolly, Carl Elliott's former aide.
It had been, oh gosh, 50 years where I had nobody to thank for changing my life, and suddenly here she is living in the same building with me. It's great.
2018 marks 60 years since the passage of the National Defense Education Act. Tens of thousands of women received financial aid under that legislation, and millions more have benefited from the federal student aid programs that followed. Carl Elliott died in 1999. This story comes to us from the podcast Ways and Means, which is produced by the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. You can listen to the full story on their website, waysandmeansshow.org. What does being loved feel like? Well, that's not only the subject of millions of songs and poems, it's also the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What makes you feel loved? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Saida Heshmati, postdoctoral research scholar at Penn State University, looks into whether actions really do speak louder than words.
We all know what it means when we talk about love in the context of romantic relationships, but do Americans agree on what indicators of feeling loved might be in their day-to-day lives? To answer this question, our research lab investigated whether there is a shared belief among the American people about feeling loved in everyday life experiences from both romantic and non-romantic perspectives. We asked 495 American adults to answer a questionnaire about whether or not they thought most people would feel loved in 60 various scenarios that could potentially lead to feeling loved. These scenarios included positive actions, like a child snuggling up to them, negative actions, like someone being possessive about them, and neutral scenarios, like the sun is shining. We found that behavioral actions rather than purely verbal expressions were more agreed upon as indicators of love among the American population. For example, more people agreed that their pets greeting them or a child snuggling with them was more loving than someone simply saying, "I love you." Participants also agreed on what doesn't make people feel loved. Behaviors that could be seen as controlling, like someone wanting to know where they are at all times, were ranked among the least loving actions. Even though the results may reflect how the American culture in general feels about love, individuals still can and do have their own personal feelings about what makes them feel loved. This is why communicating to your loved ones about what makes you feel loved can assist in being more in tune with each other in your relationships.
That was Saida Heshmati of Penn State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website, go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.